I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. My mind still guided me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem, as well as the delights of the hearts of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and in this was the reward for all my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what he has already done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said to my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will no longer be remembered in the days to come. Both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man must die too. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the works into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair all over my toilsome labors under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labours under the sun? All his days his work is pain and grief. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth, to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind.
Well, the summer is over. That might have carried more weight if I wasn't dressed for a barbecue and it was cloudy outside. But it is the 1st of September. Are you ready for back to school? Have you had an enjoyable holiday? Have the last few months been the same as any others, if you're honest? Just going to work and a bit warm in the office? Many of us think of the new academic year like January the 1st. A fresh start. A time to set new goals or improve our situations. Maybe you're thinking, If only this year the kids try harder at school. Or by Christmas I'll have that promotion. Or once school starts, I'll get back to fitness. You might be dreading the year ahead, another year of routine with nothing in particular to look forward to. Hopefully this evening we're going to have our perspective freshened up by the book of Ecclesiastes. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Even if you don't know the book itself, you may well have heard someone say that phrase, whether in truth or in jest. This is how the book begins, and it gives us a good idea of the theme. Everything is meaningless. The teacher, as he's described, is on a mission to find out the meaning of life, or what the point of life under the sun is. The word meaningless can also be translated as breath. Imagine those winter mornings not so far away now. You take a step outside and breathe out, and you can see your breath in front of your face. Then just as suddenly as it appeared, it's gone. This is how the teacher feels as he examines the different areas of life in which he could find meaning. The book of Ecclesiastes chronicles the teacher's journey with much despair and interminglings of hope. And it finishes with the phrase, "Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil." So from these bookends, we can get a glimpse of the whole book. Ecclesiastes is a book about the future, primarily because it's a book about the now. It covers the meaninglessness of life now in the light of death and God coming in judgment. It's a book aimed at shaking all of us up to see the reality of the world around us. It's a book for those of us who are sick of work and would love to just be on a beach right now. It's for parents who think this school year will be better if I'm more organised. It's for those who are in pain and in real need of physical or emotional remedy. It's to stop us thinking we'll find joy, progress, and meaning in the here and now. Ecclesiastes is going to tell us this hard truth, and Ecclesiastes may offend you. In chapter 1, we're introduced to this man, the teacher, a teacher who has more wealth, wisdom, and pleasure than we can imagine. And yet, as he looks at his life and the world around him, all is not right. And here's the offending truth. Everything you do is meaningless because death is unavoidable. This evening, I'm going to focus on chapter 2, which is a microcosm of the wider book, but also takes us through some specific scenarios and situations to help us apply the principles of Ecclesiastes to our lives. In verses 1 to 3, we learn that the teacher is looking for something greater than simply breath, something that can provide lasting pleasure and meaning in the face of inevitable death. If you look down to verse 3, you'll see that this teacher, who is also the king of Israel, isn't just some bored, self-indulgent monarch. His quest for true meaning in life is for his fellow man's sake. It's not just the king who can't be satisfied. He knows everyone is plagued with the same unsettling reality that nothing they do in this life has meaning. And so, to start off his search for lasting meaning, the teacher heads to what I'm going to loosely term as woohoo for the sake of alliteration. The seeking of pleasure in physical things, quantifiable and visible to the people around you. Look with me at verses 4 to 9. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I brought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. He owns all the houses on that road he can't afford. He has Range Rovers in every colour, just because he can. And his backyard, well, that could be mistaken for Kew Gardens. He doesn't even know his bank balance, because there's just too many digits. Nobody can claim that the teacher simply didn't pursue things well enough. If only he'd got a bit more of this, or a bit more of that, then maybe that would be the answer. No, this was the man with the resources to experience everything to its fullest. And the man whose wisdom stayed with him through all of this, not only having everything, but wisely being able to judge whether it was more than a breath. And things almost look good. Look at verse 10. Look down. He's refusing no pleasure. His heart's taking delight in it. He's rewarded for the toil. It's a high. But then we're brought crashing back to earth in verse 11. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. The pleasure, momentary. The toil was hard, and the result, fleeting. The new car's been bought, it smells great, and the best driving experience yet. And then the new car smell goes away, and a few months later, the newer model's nicer than yours. Or maybe after a year of renovating, your new house looks exactly like your Pinterest board. You're delighted with the result. But as the pleasure fades with time, your attention turns to your wardrobe. If only I could look as good as my house. Pleasure will dwindle. The cycle starts all over again. We chase after the wind. For us, it might not be things as obvious to others as a new car or a new house. Maybe it's just a clean house or the green grass. Getting a sense of value when your kids do brilliantly at school or craving they would do brilliantly at school. That feeling of achievement when someone says, well, you've just got it all together, don't you? Delighting in my financial ability to order a takeaway whenever I can't be bothered to cook. We don't need to be able to go to the extravagance of the king to put our hope and pleasure in the world around us. How do your friends or colleagues or family measure pleasure? By having. Some will be as brazen as to state it, and some will pretend it's not true. And I know I'm tempted by that idea too, which is why it's so important to hear what we're being told this evening. This will not last. This will not satisfy. It is breath. Deep down, we know this to be true, and it's borne out in our lives. Which one of us can say that we're truly satisfied with what we have, or that the thing we looked forward to buying 10 years ago still provides us and satisfies our joy today, and will do for the next 10 years? What did you think would bring you joy 10 years ago? Well, for me, in my emotional teenage years, it might have been having the latest music album. Oddly enough, that joy hasn't lasted until today, and fortunately, my music tastes have evolved too. And then, 2 years ago, getting my first paycheck, being able to afford things like a new phone. And now, my phone's getting on, I'm thinking about replacing it, and having a bit of disposable income has become normal, not exciting. None of these things could be considered anything compared to the extravagancies to which the king was able to go. He was able to show that no matter how much you get of what you get, no matter what your ability is to get it, it will never satisfy. I need to have a realistic idea of the meaninglessness of pleasure in this life so that I don't become a slave to chasing it. And it's passages like this one that will help me to do that. His pursuit of finding meaning in pleasure has collapsed. And the teacher turns his attention to the wisdom which made him able to discern the meaninglessness of the physical. Is wisdom the answer? Well, things look initially positive. Verse 13. Wisdom is greater than folly, and seeing greater than dark blindness. Now this is something we can get behind. We all know foolish decisions have devastating results. In school, we're praised when we ace the test. And who doesn't know love the feeling of knowing the answers to university challenge? And even if we're not the mastermind, if it's at work or school or in church, we love feeling valued for our wisdom and also to feel that we have more of it than someone else. All those mums in the playground asking that clever idea of yours to get the kids involved and excited about learning, being the subject matter expert in your business area or product. Everyone wants your input before making decisions. You start to speak at home group and everyone respects your evaluation of the text. Very helpful indeed. And isn't it better to be wise than foolish? You didn't buy that wardrobe as you knew you could get something on Facebook Marketplace for half the price. And your suggestions have helped the school's future decisions. And your good old common sense has helped your employer make profits. It makes a difference being wise. It helps us in the everyday and can make a difference to the people around us. And once again, the teacher, this king, has more of it than you or I will ever have. Look back to chapter 1, verse 16. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me. I have experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. If knowledge is going to bring us lasting joy, this is the man that's going to know. But look at the end of verse 14. The same fate overtakes them. Both will die. There's no differentiation when it comes to the end of life. The wise aren't given more time or a more pleasant death. Just look at the news. Whenever someone dies in a tragic accident, they're always described as bright or intelligent. And yet they die just the same. And so will I, and so will you. Maybe your company did a bit better because of your input. Maybe your useful tips helped some fellow parents out. In the end, the result is the same for everyone, and any legacy we leave behind is soon forgotten. How many of you know the names of your great-great-grandparents? Probably only a few. And if you know their names, do you know if they were wise or foolish? Has that been remembered? And so it will be with us. Nobody will know that time you proved your colleagues wrong in 100 years. Nobody will know your astute financial investment strategy. Whether wise or foolish, the end is the same. Death and forget. And so the teacher comes to a conclusion that maybe we're beginning to understand in verse 17. He hates life. Now it's probably worth giving this comment some context in the book, or we might get the false picture of the teacher giving up any and all hope in his own existence. But that's not the case. Elsewhere in the book, life is commended, even as soon as chapter 3. It's simply from what he's seen from the world of woohoo and wisdom, life has lost its sweetness. What everyone is chasing, well, it's being proved to be fruitless and not lasting. It's just a sober statement of reality. The idea of wisdom and pleasure being meaningless may not be groundbreaking to you, but I hope we've managed to glimpse how this belief can so easily creep into our thought patterns in everyday lives. And so the teacher abandons wisdom and pleasure and focuses attention once more on something that could answer his existential yet very real question: work. But Matt, I hear you cry. Surely you can't be saying work is pointless. Work existed before we rebelled against God. It must be good. Well, let's continue to look together at what God is saying in his word in the last section of Ecclesiastes 2, verses 18 to 23. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a person may labor with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then they must leave it. They must leave all they own to another who has not toiled for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What do people get for all the toil and anxious striving with which they labor under the sun? All their days, their work is grief and pain. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This too is meaningless. I can be the most excellent engineer in my company, churning out show-stopping designs again and again. But if I move to a new organization, I start from square one, needing to prove myself. You may eventually earn so much in your success that you can retire with a golf course membership and the place in Spain. But once again, what happens when I die? Well, it's left behind. My work is left behind, and I have no say to whom it's left in the end. Look at verse 19. You can toil with all skill, strive for the best thing, and then, to put it bluntly, you can leave it to a moron. But surely we gain from work in this life, even if it's lost at death. Well, verse 22 and 3 address this point. If our goal is to produce the best work we can, then it will become a source of grief and pain. Maybe it's what keeps us up at night, thinking about the problem to solve. Or it could be the frustrations with our colleagues. Why can't they just get on board with what I'm trying to do? And any mistake we make will cripple us. We'll worry that's the only thing anyone will ever remember about us. The one thing we got wrong. You'll sacrifice time with your family or friends, being able to relax and do things you enjoy, in the vain hope that at some point you succeed. Except when you hit your current goal, there's just going to be a new one put in front of you, whether by you or someone else. And where's the gain in that? I'm sure some of the employees of Carillion or Bury Football Club were excellent at their job. And yet, circumstances outside of their control led to them being made redundant and their companies, and all the excellent work they'd put into them, failing. That's certainly not going to be a source of lasting joy. And it doesn't need to be that extreme. Perhaps you just get the wrong boss. Suddenly you're undervalued, passed over for recognition, and not being used in the best way your skills could be. And then you're in verse 23, grief, pain, and sleepless nights. I think all of us who've experienced the world of work know these feelings. I've only been doing it for a couple of years, and I have. And if you're a student, or you start tomorrow, or if you're at school just thinking everything will be easy and happy when I just get a job and can work to my full potential, that's not what these verses are telling us. That's not what God is telling us. Well, in each of these three areas, from verse 1 to 23, the teacher has shown us that if our goal is the produce of pleasure, wisdom, or work, then our life will be meaningless. We need to understand this. Why is God telling us so much about how hard life will be and how there's no lasting pleasure in it? As I said at the start, Ecclesiastes is a book about the future because it's primarily a book about the present. If we have a flawed perspective on the now, we will never be able to get either the now or the future right. Without knowing the true meaninglessness of now, I will always be tempted to put at least a little bit of my hope in it, my insurance policy, or just my guilty little secret. I mean, how bad is it really to hope for things now? What harm does it do? And if we were left with nothing to fill the space left behind, then we would inevitably fall back into these things. But fortunately for you and me, that's not where we're left by the teacher. He's cut down our old false view of the world, and now he wants to transplant a new perspective in its place. And so that's where the teacher goes in verse 24, to the new perspective. A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God, for without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the person who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Now, it's easy to think he's simply contradicting everything he's just said. Did you notice the difference? In every other endeavour, he's been chasing after the result. Whereas here he says that the way to find pleasure is just to go about your toil with joy. It's only possible to grasp this if we truly understand that what we produce isn't going to bring us lasting delights. Therefore, by knowing the end isn't the goal in itself, we can enjoy the tasks to get there, and whatever measure of woohoo, work or wisdom we're given, knowing it's a gift from God to be given any at all. In some way, it's like the difference between the elite athletes and the fun runners in the London Marathon. For one, the goal is to win and get the glory and pleasure in doing so. And for the person dressed up in a replica of Big Ben, the win's not their aim, and so they can just enjoy the run itself. It's the difference between ambitiously trying to climb the ladder at work, clamouring for promotions, or simply being content to put food on the table. And by doing so, having the freedom to enjoy your work. Or to experience the fleeting pleasures in this life without trying to hold on to them forever. Only by not chasing these fleeting pleasures and seeing them as they are, meaningless or breath, we can have this mindset. And we can only have this mindset through God. Look at verse 26. But to the sinner he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The sinner, that is those who don't know God, and therefore can't see this greater perspective, chases after woohoo, wisdom and work, in this life, only for the produce to be handed over on their inevitable death. It might be a pretty offensive thing to hear, I'm aware of that, but it's a true thing that we need to hear. And hopefully it makes some sense too. If I seek only the pleasure that things provide, I'll always be disappointed when the pleasure isn't as complete or as long-lasting as I'd hoped. Yet if my goal isn't that pleasure, then it's always going to be a pleasant surprise when it comes. Maybe this is all new or a bit confusing to you. How on earth can this make sense? Well, again, this is a book about the future because it's about the now. To those that please God, that is, those that are following him, we can be sure of a much greater future, one which promises all the things that are described as meaningless breath in this passage. If you have no hope of a future, then of course you're going to strive for pleasure and gain in this life and think it's a meaningful investment. But only in the light of eternity can it be seen for what it truly is. There's much in this book, Ecclesiastes, on the subject of death. It's a very simple reality to the writer, who it's worth remembering how great wisdom to understand these things and explain them to us. There will be nothing left under the sun of you when you die. There is no hope in this life of itself. It must be outside of the here and now, outside of under the sun. This is a sobering reality presented before us in Ecclesiastes, from a time when God's full plan hadn't yet been revealed, with the teacher trying to follow God in a clearly broken world. And our temptation would be to try and section this off as some sort of, well, the good news comes later, so we can sort of ignore or sweep under the carpet the hard bits in the Old Testament, because they don't really apply anymore. And yet, this theme of the foolishness of chasing after the wind isn't one that disappears in the New Testament. In fact, it's one that Jesus himself picks up on in Mark chapter 8. I'll read you verses 34 to 36. Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul?" Jesus is saying the same thing as our Ecclesiastes teacher. Want to live for the here and now? Then it will be proven to be nothing, and it'll cost you eternity. There's no good in having everything. Everything the teacher had, everything you or I desire. Cars, money, property, a tidy living room, peace and quiet and well-behaved children, if you forfeit your soul. That is, if you don't turn to God and follow him. And so instead of being an inconvenient truth confined to the Old Testament and the world before Jesus, what we've read this evening is as timely now as it was then, and something we really need to strive to understand. Only by understanding the meaninglessness of the now will we be able to live a life with our eyes wholeheartedly fixed on the future and fixed on Jesus. As I've been studying this book, I've been struck by how quick I am to forget these things. When I spend time with my family, friends, or colleagues who aren't following Jesus, it's clear that many of them are happy in their lives, running after the momentary pleasures that the world can offer. But we need to remind ourselves that it is meaningless. Simply breath on a winter morning, disappearing, never to be seen again. They are blind to this truth, and we can be very easily blinded by it too. When that temptation strikes, it's passages like this one that will renew our perspective, helping us live life now, firmly focused on the future ahead. I pray this helps us as we set off into the new academic year. And so why don't we pray to that end now? Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Please would you help us to apply it this week to our lives. We're sorry for when we chase after meaningless things. Would you help us to have a new perspective, with our eyes fixed on Christ and the future, to replace those things? Help us to live only for your glory and not ourselves. Amen.